Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. In all of the stories I've presented on this show, I realized recently that practically zero have explored the subject of parenting. This is probably due to the fact that I think about children and child rearing rarely, since I'm not a parent myself. But there is a podcast I listen to regularly that's 100% about parenting, but it's presented in a way that's entertaining to just about anyone. Launched in 2010 by author and radio producer Hilary Frank, WNYC's The Longest Shortest Time is an earnest, funny, and very human podcast about parenting. And it's one that's given me a lot of perspective on the trials my friends who are parents are going through. In this episode of the podcast, Hilary interviews Ann Saylor, who teaches music classes for babies and toddlers and their caregivers. When Ann brought her newborn son home from the hospital, her baby just wouldn't stop screaming. It would start every night and would just go on for hours and hours. Then one night, Ann had an epiphany.
And I thought, all right, I can sing.
I have this power,
right. And this power has been passed down to me from, you know, through generations in my family. And we can do the lullaby thing.
Okay, so do you remember what the first song was that you tried?
Yeah, I tried Baby's Boat, which is the song that my grandmother sang to my mother and my mother sang to me. Baby's boat has silver moon. And it totally didn't work. He, if anything, screamed louder, and he was arching his back, you know, like, no, this is absolutely the worst thing you could possibly do.
Sail, baby, sail out across that sea. Only don't forget to sail back again to me.
And then I started to get a little bit, you know, in my head about it. And I'm like, well, clearly listen to the words, you know, the baby's like sailing out away from its mother.
So in your head, you were thinking he's reacting badly to the words.
He's reacting badly to the words. Maybe it's the tune. You know, I know some grown-ups process minor songs as sad. So then I started to sing You Are My Sunshine.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know.
So he continued to arch his back and scream.
Please don't take my sunshine away.
All of a sudden the words, please don't take my sunshine away. Now I'm like, oh my God, again, I've got this song that has some crazy, terrible subtext.
So what happened that night?
I felt like we'd try a lot of things to help this baby not be in so much discomfort or pain, or and ourselves to be in so much discomfort and pain. And when I had that aha, that, oh, I can sing, you know, that'll soothe him, and that didn't work. It really did feel like that was the last good idea that I had. And I felt like, like what I had to give wasn't enough. Couldn't help him.
I totally know what you're talking about. Absolutely. So your son is now 10 years old, and he can talk,
yeah,
and express himself in ways other than arching his back. How does he feel about lullabies now?
Oh, that's an interesting question. My daughter is 2 years younger than Jacob, and one night I was in her room singing her a lullaby, and he was in his room next door, and he called out, Mom, can you please stop singing? It really interferes with my going to sleep process.
He said it like that?
He said just exactly like that.
he's a precocious little guy, but,
you know, we ran in to Jacob's science teacher at this restaurant opening in town, and she came over and she said to me, does he sing at home as much as he sings in class? And I had no idea how to answer it because I don't know how much he sings in class, right? And she said, yeah, he's almost constantly singing. So I think that he uses music to process the world. And thinking about this whole lullaby context, knowing now how musically charged he is, it really does help me feel like he wasn't rejecting music, or wasn't rejecting me.
Anne Saylor is a Music Together teacher and jewelry designer in Montclair, New Jersey. This piece was produced by Hilary Frank and aired as the very first episode of the podcast, The Longest Shortest Time, from WNYC. This weekend, Hilary is bringing The Longest Shortest Time to the Bay Area for a few special events. Luckily for us, she spent some time with me earlier this week to discuss how she launched an intimate little show that grew into one of the most downloaded podcasts on parenting.
So, I had my daughter 5 years ago, and I had a really rough childbirth and recovery. I had an injury that I didn't fully recover from for 3 years. And we moved pretty soon after my daughter was born to a town where I didn't know anybody. And it was really hard to make friends. Like, I was having trouble recovering. And I just, like, I was looking around and seeing it looked like it was easier for everybody else. And, but like, then when I really got a chance to talk to people, I found out that, like, everyone was struggling in some way. But it's really hard to just walk up to strangers in a town you just moved to and be like, hey, you know, like, can we talk in a really deep way about this experience we're having? And so, you know, I had almost 15 years under my belt as a radio producer, and I knew that if you stick a microphone in somebody's face, you kind of have license to ask them anything. And so I started this podcast, and you know, podcasting wasn't as big as it was back then, and it felt really safe to just, like, start this show out of my home office and like, call people up and ask them really deeply personal questions about life with a child. That it didn't feel safe asking in real life. Back when I started it, it was me sitting on a bed with, like, my field microphone, calling people on the phone, and we would schedule it. Like, me and the other mom would, like, schedule it when our babies were napping. Like, we would find a mutually agreeable time, and it could get difficult if, like, the person was on a different coast than me. But we could always sort of carve out, like, 20 minutes to half an hour for me to talk to somebody. And the thing that was cool is that it was really cathartic for me. You know, like, I started this show as sort of, like, it was a selfishly motivated thing. You know, it was to make me feel better and less alone. And the thing that I didn't really count on right away was that it would be cathartic for other people too. And like, pretty early on in the show, after every show, I would say, if you have a story of a surprising struggle in parenthood that you want me to consider for this podcast, email me. And pretty quickly, I started hearing from strangers, and would just have these intimate conversations during my daughter's nap time, sitting on my bed with this microphone with complete strangers. And often they would cry, and it was an experience I've never had before.
Do you, because the show's now, you've got, like, you have over 50 episodes now from the past several years. That's awesome. So are there times that stick out when a parent or, you know, a listener, is there a memorable moment of, like, really feeling that impact that your show that started so personally really affected other people?
Yeah, I mean, we hear from people daily. We're talking about really universal subjects, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff comes up when you have a kid. Like, my kid is obsessed with talking about death, and
that's kind of always interesting to hear about. Hearing people being up in the middle of the night, like pulling their hair out, is always kind of interesting to hear about. We talk a lot about illnesses and the surprising ways they can present. And I just think like those are the kinds of things that just humans want to hear about.
I have a lot of friends asking for my recommendations of podcasts to listen to, especially podcasts hosted or produced by women. So I wanted to ask, are there any you've been listening to that you really dig lately?
So I've got to admit that I don't listen to as many podcasts as I would like to. I don't find that I have the time to set aside to do that. But when I do, there are a few that I keep turning to. You know, like everybody else, I got on the Serial train and really enjoyed that. I always love Terry Gross. You know, she's not new, but I always feel like her interviews are, you know, some of the best out there. I also really like Death, Sex, and Money with Anna Sale. That's another WNYC podcast. And the one that I just am always turning to first when I look in my podcast app is YOY with Andrea Salenzi. Andrea does this podcast about dating, and she talks about relationships and sex, and a lot of it is about her own life. And she gets really personal, and she just takes these risks. She blends the line between fact and fiction sometimes, and she's got a voice. You know, I don't mean her physical voice. I mean, she's got a perspective, you know, a point of view on the world. And she seems, from her podcast, unafraid to express that point of view, even when it puts her in a really vulnerable position. And I think, you know, we're at a time where podcasting is more mainstream now. And I get afraid when you see something getting more mainstream that people are going to take fewer risks because, you know, you might not be able to get money for something that's more risky. So I love that Andrea is out there. I love that she's a woman taking risks, and I want to see more of that.
I'd like to tell fans of The Longest Shortest Time that you're going to be coming to the Bay Area this week. Could you tell us what we can look forward to?
Yeah, so we're doing two events. One is with 99% Invisible host Roman Mars. And I am going to be taping a live episode of the podcast with Roman. Roman is the father of twin boys. And so I'm going to be talking to him about raising his twins and also about hosting his podcast. And also, we're bringing this event that's sort of become our signature event, Speed Dating for Mom Friends, to Viracocha on Saturday.
What's Speed Dating for Mom Friends?
Yeah, so it's like, it's kind of just what it sounds like. It's meant to give moms an easier opportunity to meet other moms that they really click with. Like, it's not hard to meet other parents, but something I've found a lot of the moms talking about in like our Facebook group and moms that I meet are just always complaining that it's really hard to meet people that you feel like aren't going to judge you or like you have anything in common with at all. And it feels like dating. It feels like you go on these play dates or, you know, go out for coffee with people. And so we're taking some of the guesswork out of it, and we set up these little speed dating rounds.
And if people want to attend either Thursday or Saturday's events, is there one place that they can find all the information?
Yeah, they can go to longestshortesttime.com to the events section.
And you're also launching an app, right?
Yeah, we are. And we're actually launching it at our events at the Bay Area. And we're really excited about this thing. It does three things. So first of all, you can listen to the entire archive of the show. Second, you can get help if you need it with your kids or yourself or your partner or your friends. And we have a curated list of resources in there organized by topic. And the third thing, which I think is the coolest thing, is that it has this talk section where listeners can record answers to our questions and send us audio for us to use on the show. You just go to the iTunes store, download the app. It's called Longest Shortest Time. And record your answer to the question, and you send it to us, and we're going to be picking our favorites to play at our two Bay Area events. And we're actually also going to be using our favorites in our broadcast on the podcast of our Roman Mars episode.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today, Hillary.
Thank you for having me.
For more info on how you can get tickets to this Saturday's Speed Dating for Mom Friends event, head to longestshortesttime.com. You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. When Hillary mentioned Roman Mars, it reminded me of one of my favorite 99% Invisible episodes, all about an almost beloved kid's toy. From the 99% Invisible archives, here's Roman's director's cut of the story of Billy Possum.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. It's totally unfair. Hydrox cookies came out in 1908. Oreos didn't show up until 4 years later. But it didn't matter. Hydrox could never shake the image of being a knockoff, and also ran. Hydrox lovers would champion its tangier cream filling. Vegetarians would praise them for being cruelty-free, while America's favorite cookie, the Oreo, contained animal lard until the mid-90s. As a consumer product, it's just not up to you. Sometimes you're deemed the mighty transformer, and sometimes you're the loathsome GoBot.
One shall stand, and one shall fall.
It's capricious who wins. Swiss cake roll versus ho-ho, Twizzler versus red vine. Maybe yours was the first family on the block with the technologically superior Betamax player, only to be overwhelmed by the mediocre VHS tape. Sometimes it doesn't make any sense at all. But sometimes it does.
I'm John Mualim.
John is a writer for the New York Times Magazine and a writer at large for Pop-Up Magazine,
the live magazine in San Francisco,
where this story first appeared.
Right, so it's 1902, and Theodore Roosevelt is president.
And he decides to vacation in a town called Smeads in the Mississippi woods, where he can hunt black bear.
He's a big outdoorsman, big hunter.
And this hunting trip became kind of a famous story.
Basically, he had spent a few days hunting, and I don't think they even saw a single bear. They definitely didn't get to shoot at any. And then one morning, the dogs get the scent of a bear, and they follow it down into this really weedy place where the president's guide says, you know what, don't even bother going in there and troubling yourself. I'll go in and I'll flush the bear out. You just stay here and I'll flush it right to you.
So Roosevelt waits and waits, but then he gets bored and decides to go off and eat lunch.
Eventually, the dogs do corner the bear, and the guide, not really knowing what to do, leaps off his horse, cracks the bear over the head with the butt of his rifle, knocks it unconscious or semi-unconscious, and ties it to a tree, and then starts blowing away on his bugle, trying to call Roosevelt back so that the president can be the one who has the honor of shooting it.
Roosevelt hears the bugle and makes his way back to the hunting party.
And what he finds is this bear. It's a female bear. It weighs about 235 pounds, and it's tied to a tree. It's still semi-conscious, it's injured, it looks a little mangy. It's actually probably about half as heavy and big as it should be, but there's been a real drought going on in the area.
The bear looks pathetic, and Roosevelt takes pity on it.
He decides that it's unsportsmanlike to shoot this thing. You know, he's not going to do it, and he doesn't want anyone else to do it either. So he lowers his gun, and in this sort of merciful moment is, you know, word of this spreads, and a political cartoonist draws a cartoon of the moment of him, you know, showing the bear this mercy. And the way the cartoonist draws the bear is almost like a little Labrador puppy or a golden retriever puppy. It's sort of on its butt and its hind legs, and it's got these big round perked up ears, almost like Mickey Mouse, and these big wide eyes, and it's staring at the president, waiting to see what its fate will be.
The cartoon was called Drawing the Line in Mississippi.
And from that, basically spawned the teddy bear. This adorable little bear in the cartoon was turned into a three-dimensional plush toy.
The very first teddy bear was either made by a German company called Stief or a Brooklyn toy store owner, depending on who you ask.
And they name it after Theodore Roosevelt. They call it Teddy's Bear.
It's a huge sensation.
And it's actually more popular than baby dolls, which freaks everyone out a little bit. You know, why should their children be playing with bears and not dolls? It's a little savage. And within a few years, I think Steve is producing close to 1 million teddy bears a year and shipping them to the U.S.
But it was considered so bizarre that kids would play with a stuffed bear that people just assumed it was a novelty. And as soon as Roosevelt left office, no one would want them anymore.
And at this time, the whole idea of mass-produced toys was also really new. So the toy industry wanted to kind of capitalize on its rally and keep it going. So it was really looking for whatever was going to be the next cuddly plaything that American kids were going to want, although it had no idea what that might be.
So fast forward to 1909. And Roosevelt's term is about up, and the president-elect is Roosevelt's hand-picked successor, William Howard Taft.
And that January 1909, Taft is in Atlanta. He's trying to woo the South, try to convince them that his administration is going to, you know, take them seriously as a constituency. And he's the guest of honor at this banquet.
And the Chamber of Commerce in Atlanta decides it's going to serve him the truest, most unpretentious Southern dish around.
It's something that a writer of the time, I found this little book about Southern food from the time, calls it the Christmas goose of the Epicurean Negro.
The meal was possum and taters.
And what it was an opossum would be roasted on a bed of sweet potatoes and then presented whole on a platter with its head on, its tail on, and it, often you'd get a smaller little sweet potato crammed between the animal's teeth. 50 teeth.
By the way, 50 teeth is apparently the most teeth of any North American mammal.
Which is fascinating. In the end, the one that they brought to Taft's table weighed 18 pounds. All of a sudden, the orchestra strikes up and the guests burst into song. Suddenly, Taft is presented with this surprise gift, and it's a small, stuffed opossum toy.
And this is a brand new invention that some local Taft supporters are trying to position as William Taft's presidency's answer to the teddy bear.
They're calling it the Billy Possum. Already there was a company set up called the Georgia Billy Possum Company. According to one account, within 24 hours of that banquet, there were already deals being brokered for Billy Possums with distributors across the country. In covering the banquet, the LA Times announced that the teddy bear has been relegated to a seat in the rear, and for 4 years, possibly eight, the children of the United States will play with Billy Possums.
So from then on, a bit of possum mania started. There were Billy Possum postcards,
Billy Possum pins, Billy Possum pictures for your cream when you had coffee. There was a ragtime tune called Possum, the Latest Craze. And as Taft traveled around the South, some people actually started giving him live opossums in cages when he would make public appearances, sort of handing them over like they were floral bouquets.
Soon, Billy Possums were in toy stores from New York to San Francisco.
Because real opossums weren't actually that common in cities then, and no one really knew what they were, a toy store in Brooklyn ran an in-store promotion with a live captive opossum that they could show off to kids so the kids could familiarize themselves with what this new animal they were going to be best friends with was. I found an advertisement for the store that read, "Do not let it be said that any man, woman, or child in Brooklyn has not seen the cute little animal whose name is mentioned more in all parts of the world today than any other." Previously, there had been poems in newspapers sort of mourning the passing of the dolls and how sad it was that these teddy bears were coming into nurseries and vanquishing them. And now there were poems in newspapers about Billy Possums displacing teddy bears.
But since you probably never heard of a Billy Possum, you can guess what comes next.
It was a total flop, and the Billy Possum was forgotten and almost entirely out of stores within a couple of months. So in other words, the Billy Possum never even made it to see Christmas time, which is a special kind of tragedy for a toy.
There are several possible explanations as to why the Billy Possum never took off. The first, and probably what you're thinking right now, is this. Opossums are ugly, and nobody likes them. But it was also the dawn of the mechanical toy, and even some teddy bears had evolved into wind-up animatrons.
There was a French-made teddy bear that, quote, winds up and is calculated to indulge in a number of ludicrous somersaults.
How could a limp, stuffed Billy Possum compete with that? But John Mooallem argues that, at its heart, the acceptance of teddy bear and the rejection of Billy Possum comes down to their origin stories.
In the story that was told about Roosevelt and this bear, it was a very kind of tender moment where Roosevelt was showing the bear mercy. And when you looked at that cartoon, the way the bear was drawn, it looked like something that you would want to just sweep up into your arms and take care of, and that was vulnerable and that needed your help.
It looked like a teddy bear as we know it, although no one knew it at the time.
The story with Taft, it didn't give it anything else. You know, Taft ate his opossum for supper, and he ate a lot of it, and he ate so much that after his first several helpings, a doctor seated nearby apparently passed him a note suggesting that it might be a good idea if he slowed down a little.
Taft even bragged to reporters the next day about how much possum he consumed.
Well, I like opossum, and I ate very heartily of it last night, and it did not disturb in the slightest my digestion or my sleep.
The possum was vulnerable, I guess, splayed out on a bed of taters, but you're not exactly rooting for it.
I started feeling really bad for Taft, who, you know, the more I read a little bit about him, he was this totally colorless politician, and he didn't actually even want to be president by some accounts. He was sort of strong-armed into it by Roosevelt, and he never really measured up to Roosevelt's charisma and charm. I mean, Roosevelt was the kind of guy who, you know, no matter what he did, history seemed eager to glorify him for it.
Case in point, the messed up thing about the famous story of Teddy's bear on that hunting trip in Mississippi is it isn't even the whole truth.
You have to remember that Roosevelt was a hunter. He was there to hunt bears. He wasn't a PETA activist or something like this. While he did show the bear mercy, it was a very particular kind of mercy. After he refused to shoot it, he said, "Put it out of its misery." And then one of his hunting buddies came in and slit the bear's neck open with a knife. They carried the bear's body back to camp over the back of a horse, and they basically ate off it for the next several days. And on the last night of their trip, they finished it off. They roasted its paws, and I kid you not, they ate the paws with a side of possum and taters.
So that's why you will never cuddle up with a billy possum. Just like you will never watch a Betamax tape or travel to Gobatron with Leader One. And you will never again dunk a Hydrox cookie. Man, I miss Hydrox cookies. Well, they were really tasty.
That episode of 99% Invisible was produced by Roman Mars and John Mualim, based off a piece John presented at Pop-Up Magazine, Issue 5, in San Francisco. You can find more episodes of 99% Invisible at 99pi.org and at kalw.org. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. A big special thanks to Hillary Frank for joining us today. If you weren't able to see her this evening, there's info about her Saturday event up now at kalw.org. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.